Mom. Good evening, good morning, and good afternoon to all of you in all the different parts of the world. I'm speaking to you from Carmel Valley, California, where it's the end of a very beautiful, crazy warm California afternoon. And today we're going to flow even more granularly into what really is the heart of the recognition sutras, which is to recognize and to begin to unpack the actual nature of contraction as we experience it on a day-to-day basis. So I also just want to say a couple of words about the way in which the class is landing. I'm loving the way so many of you are engaging on the listserv, and the way that you're more and more willing to express deep stuff, to run to each other, and I feel really allow a safe space in which you can be real with each other. And I know that sometimes the listserv and the reactions that people offer you on the listserv can be very, very affirming, and sometimes they can kind of trigger old patterns that we've been experiencing in ourselves since childhood, and I think most of you know that this is part of the effect of satsang, of sangham, and I actually think that it's one of the gifts of sangham. That is, there's a kind of a mirroring process that happens in coming together in this way that can genuinely cause us to be able to see stuff that we couldn't necessarily see normally. So we experience the roles that we tend to form in that we tend to take on in groups. Someone mentioned that she was manifesting the rebel outsider. Sometimes we become the person who knows everything, or the mediator, the one who, wants to kind of smooth things over, or the person who just doesn't get it. It's like all of these roles, which, according to our text, are roles in consciousness, become sort of, they sort of show up in high relief in these dialogues. So even though we're virtual, we are still being held in my experience, Shakti's empowered awakening cauldron, where her energy can empower us to see and experience and work with whatever comes up. And as many of you are sharing, the more we can hold the big view that this study offers, the more we can actually start to see and tune into and integrate the resistances, the triggers, the fears, the self-doubts, which are markers of contraction. So clearly we all have our own personal symptoms of contraction, but the truth is that just as we share more DNA than we, I mean, as most of our DNA is shared with all living beings, so our contraction is shared pretty much with all living beings. That's part of what starts to become apparent to us when we study these texts. I have always been kind of amazed when I work with, for instance, one of my intense emotions, when something like anger comes up or grief comes up, and I work with it, what I almost always start to recognize is that this is, even though I may have reasons for being angry and tendencies to be angry or sad or whatever, that the actual experience of anger or sadness is not mine. It is actually a universal manifestation of contraction. And in other words, it's never just your anger. It's the anger. It's never just your sadness. It's the sadness. These are feelings that are shared by everybody. And it's one of the reasons why practices like Tonglen, where you breathe in other people's fear or sadness and then breathe happiness into them. It's one of the reasons why practices like that are so effective in loosening the boundaries between yourself and the rest of the world. The tantric sages want us to not just try to get rid of our feelings and the states that arise from them. They want us to actually interact with them and learn how to divinize them, become intimate with them, and to see that all of it really is a part of Shakti's manifestation. And I want to say one more thing. For me, the great gift of immersing myself in non-dual teachings is the way in which, over the years, these teachings have supported me in identifying with the true self, you know, the awareness self, even as I work with the stuff that cures it. So, you know, I never... in my early years of, you know, doing various therapeutic modules and trying to become a happier, better person, when I was in my 20s, I never could fully look into the stuff that was causing me the deepest pain because I didn't want to admit that I was that kind of person. I wanted to have a sort of an unflawed image of myself because seeing myself as having flaws or problems was just too painful. And it was really only after I began having experiences of the self, the inner presence in the heart, the lightness of the heart, that I began to be able to face into the obscurities, the obscuration, limitations, the personal neuroses, all that stuff that caused moment-to-moment suffering, and actually work with it without pretending it wasn't there, because it's the more we can really learn to take seriously and identify with what we are at the deepest level, the more we can begin to really embrace, be kind to the contracted parts of ourselves. And when we can do that, the love, which is Chitti's real nature, starts to swallow them up, and we'll see that in some of the later sutras. But I want to give a shout out right now for your homework and for doing your homework. Because even though I know we're really busy, and I know that for some of you, weeks will go by when it's all you can do to listen to the class and do a little meditation, I think you'll notice that if you spend even a couple minutes a day working with some of the contemplation and self-inquiry exercises in the homework, it really makes a difference. The homework that I send you, the handouts that I send you, and I know there's a lot in them, so you're expected to do it all. It's really there so that you can find out what is most powerful for you at any given moment. So I really want to ask you to spend some time reciting the Sanskrit in the sutras, holding the meaning of the Sanskrit, and then taking some time to work with some of the questions, wrap your mind around some of the teachings, even when you feel like you don't understand it or when it's sending you into a meditative state that feels like sleep. I can tell you from my experience, and a lot of you have shared this, that when you work it, you know, when you hold it, when you come back to it again and again, your mind shifts, your consciousness shifts, the alchemical power in these teachings starts to show you how creative the texture of your own mind is, and even of your own body. So let's begin by chanting our two introductory verses. We'll chant along with Scott. And then we'll meditate. So, Dev, can you?
Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne. Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute
And you can refresh your posture. Just take a moment to feel the breath flowing down towards the base of the posture and see if you can feel that relaxation that comes when you take the support of your seat, the support of the earth. And then with the exhalation, let the breath gently elongate your spinal column upward through the crown. Your shoulder blades release onto the back. Your chest opens. And you begin to become aware of the natural flow of the breath. As you sit, see if you can allow the full experience of the body that you're inhabiting, to come into your awareness. And see if, as you do, you can let go of the concept body. In other words, rather than feeling, okay, this is my body, it starts here, it ends here, it's got all these organs crammed into it. See if you can just experience the body as a kind of field of sensation or vibration. Yes, there's some density in some parts of it, some lightness in others. But if you don't have the thought body, if you're just attending to your actual felt experience, what you're experiencing or feeling is actually a collection of sensations that have this quality of vibration, of energy, of what those of us who like to give Sanskrit names to our experience might call Shakti or Spanda. Just let yourself settle into this field of sensation and vibration. And see if you can begin to feel that the breath, the prana shakti, is flowing through this field of sensation, not just through what you might call your nostrils, but through the whole front of the field. So that the air flows in like a soft vibratory wind that can actually be felt interpenetrating the pores of your skin, the pores of vibration that we ordinarily call skin. If you didn't have a concept of breath, you wouldn't necessarily refer to this experience anything. You simply be aware there's a very delicate, very subtle vibration seems to be flowing in and out. Through the whole front of me.
Sally, your phone is garbling a little bit. I'm sorry to interrupt that, but I just wanted to let you know we're losing you.
Effects of the post-eclipse situation. So, though that conversation probably brought you right back into inside and outside, let's see if we can flow back into the sense of the breathing body, the vibrating space, with the breath flowing in through the front, as though the breathing coming in through the front of this field is connecting what feels like inside with what feels like outside. So that the breath is drawing in the whole space in front and then thawing it out. Now see if you can sense the same energetic vibration that is breathing prana into your inner field. See if you can sense that flowing in from behind, flowing in from behind the field of the body, drawing in the space behind, so that you're breathing, or rather, breath is flowing from behind the body, drawing in the whole space behind the body, and then with the exhalation, flowing it out. So that perhaps you are beginning to feel that the boundaries of what we call body are permeable and porous to the breath, to the flow of breath. Now see if you can draw in the whole space on the right side, allowing the breath to permeate this vibration of body with its subtle vibration, its subtle energy from the right. Drawing in the whole area to the right and then allowing it to flow out again. And now, from the left side, feel the breath flowing in, drawing in the sphere of energy to your left, into the body, and then with the exhalation, allowing the space at the left side of the body to open and join with the space inside. And can you draw in the breath from below the body? The particles of prana shakti flowing through, even through the apparently solid matter that you're sitting on, flowing into the body and then flowing back out with the exhalation. And now feel the breath flowing in through the crown, drawing in the energy of sky, the energy of sun, the energy of stars and moon, drawing it in through the crown of the head and allowing it to flow through the body, through the space, the vibratory space that we call body, and then flow out through the crown with the exhalation. Before you open your eyes, and of course you don't have to open your eyes unless you want to, just stay for a moment with this sense of your inner experience of your embodied self being not dense, but actually vibratory, energetic, like a subtle field of energy through which the breath passes. And realize as we go into the class and into the discussions and conversations that this is what your body most deeply is. It is energy. Breath is energy. Air is energy. The separation that we feel is the result of the contractions that we are about to discuss tonight. So I want to say we're discussing Sutra 9, and in order to do that, we're going to skip Sutras 7 and 8, not because they're not fascinating, but actually because of the amount of time we have to move through the arc of the recognition story. And I would say that Sutra 7 is kind of a geek sutra. It describes an aspect of the process of moving through the tattvas, which is interesting if you like the technicalities, but was pretty much covered in the second week when we discussed the tattvas. Sutra 8 is a sutra that I love, and Alice was writing it in the listserv about it today. It's what I call the Comparative Religion Sutra, and it gives a very step-by-step, let's say, discussion and refutation of the positions of different philosophies. And Chris Wallace's book, The Recognition Sutras, has an extremely detailed and interesting unpacking of this sutra, if you would like to read it, if you have the book. But what Kshemaraja does is actually very interesting, because in some ways it prefigures the postmodern discussions of religious traditions. The sutra says the positions of the various philosophical arguments express the different roles that the self assumes at different levels of consciousness. So basically what he's saying is that every religious position is partially true, or true at the level at which the people who are living by that tradition experience the world. And more than that, each religious and spiritual philosophy expresses a position of the self at one of the tattvas. So, for example, there's a very, very well-known and very well-established materialist philosophy that was current in India for a long time, along with the more unmaterialist philosophies. And he points out that this is the experience of Shiva, Shakti, when they're fully embodied at earth tattva, and the philosophical arguments of the Buddhists and the Vedantins come from higher tattvas, more subtle tattvas. And it, of course, his ultimate conclusion is that the teachings of the non-dual Shaiva Tantra are the highest and encompass all the other stages. But I think the important point about what he says is that in the tantric traditions, we don't identify only with the material, like the materialists do. We don't identify only with the transcendental, as the Vedantins do. He's a little bit setting up a straw man here, but be that as it may. He's inviting us to recognize the both and, the fact that the divine is in the world and beyond the world. Pure stillness, pure ground of beingness, pure power and creativity, and that these aspects, these qualities, which we are using words for because you have to use words, but which are clearly not confined to language, these aspects of the great reality, Shiva Shakti, beingness and energy, are dancing in every particle of the world. It's when we have that recognition that no matter what we feel, the pure self, the pure Shakti is always dancing inside that experience, meaning inside our resistance, inside our struggles, inside our physical pain, inside the deep waters of our personal karmas or our heartbreak or our social action. That untouched bliss of the self is always there in the background, and our job is to touch it. Like Sharon's description last week of being on a mountain and being lifted into a higher awareness. Nonetheless, even when we're not in that higher awareness, it's still there. At the same time, something prevents us in our ordinary state of consciousness from realizing that. And Sutra 9 explains why this happens and what it entails. So, Sutra 9 which is actually one of my favorite sutras, and it was one that my friends, the people who studied it with me, and I used to throw at each other all the time. The Sanskrit says, Chidvat tat shakti sankochat mala vritaha samsarin. Due to contraction, the supremely free chitti becomes a samsaric wanderer covered by veils or impurities. A mala covered samsaran. So let me just walk through the Sanskrit for a moment. Chidvat means that shakti, full of awareness, freedom, and power. Sankochat means contracts. Mala means impurity or dirt or veil, like the dust on the mirror or the soot in the chimney of an oil lamp. So a mala is a covering which hides or veils the inner light and our connectedness. Reducing Shiva, reducing the expanded soul, Shiva Shakti, to a contracted state, to the state of a limited individual experiencing suffering. Vritaha means covering. And samsara, which is a word that I think all of you know, samsara means wandering. And that word samsara, of course, is one of the most potent words in the Eastern tradition. It has a great sound, very sweet, and in fact, it was the name of a perfume that was popular in the 80s and early 90s, maybe still is. I never thought it was a great name for a perfume, because what samsara really means is our inability to rest in awareness, the mind. It refers to the mind that constantly wanders, and it also refers to the effect of this constantly wandering mind, which is the wandering between bodies and lives that is called the cycle of transmigration. The macro process of samsara is this endless wandering from body to body and from world to world, and sometimes in some traditions from species to species. And a samsaran is a little bit, I've always felt that the Alzheimer's patients that leave home and then can't find their way back is a perfect example of how samsara actually works. And Indian spiritual poetry, of course, is full of laments about the sheer impermanence of life, how you can never be sure of anything. So as the poet Mirabai sings, one day I'm riding on an elephant, the next day I'm walking in the dust. That's samsara. This sutra aims to explain how samsara happens, and it is actually the sutra about the cause of suffering. So if you don't mind a little reminder of how suffering is often held in different traditions, because of course suffering is the big problem for religions. You know, there's God, and then there's suffering, and how can that happen? It's a big argument in Christianity and Judaism. How can there be evil in a world in which God is good, in which God is divine? The religious traditions come up with different explanations, and the Jews and the Christian in Judaism, it's really the result of disobeying God. You know, listening to the temptations of Satan, who took the form of the serpent in the Garden of Eden and said, "Eat from the tree of knowledge," and there's all sorts of interpretations of what the tree of knowledge is. But the point is that there's a projection going on here, that because if we think that God is only good, then we have to find some other force which causes the problem. And in the Abrahamic traditions, that force is called in Arabic Shaitan, which is of course also his name in Judaism and one of his names in Christianity. And as God is a male, Satan is a male. In the Eastern tradition, the in Vedanta especially, the villain is Maya, and in that case, she's female. In Vedanta, they kind of resolve the problem by seeing the cause of evil and suffering and cruelty and all the terrible things about life in this world. they see the root of the problem as ignorance, which is pretty much the position that most of us in the yoga community hold. But in other words, our problems are the result of a mistake, an error in our understanding of reality. But as the tantricas point out, when the Advaita Vedantins talk about ignorance, they end up in a sort of subtle duality because they manage to make the veiling power, Maya, kind of not quite part of the absolute. So they Maya is it's a sort of a confusingly separate but not separate power of the absolute, but still somehow an other, disturbing the oneness, throwing consciousness off its game. It's very similar to the story of the Buddha's awakening, you know, where he's seen wrestling Mara, the evil tempter, who manifests, you know, who agitates his mind by sending beautiful women to awaken his lust and sending armies to awaken his fear and anger. And Buddha, of course, manages to stay steady throughout all this. But again, Mara is not seen in Buddhism as a part of the oneness. Of course, Buddhism does not talk about God, but Mara is not seen as part of Buddha's own psyche, as, you know, as a modern person probably would, but as an outside force. The tantras, the non-dual tantras anyway, the way they account for the fact that even though Chitti Shakti has become all this, we're not able to experience it, the way they account for it is through the contraction of the divine powers and the imposition of the three malas. And the three malas are anavamala, which is the impurity of individuality or smallness, mayamala, which is the impurity that causes a sense of differentiation, everything being different than everything else, and karma mala, which works through the senses and the organs of action and creates the illusion that you and I are personally responsible for the actions that are actually being carried out by Shakti herself, by consciousness herself, who, remember, has manifested as the body and as the outside world. But when karma mala is in operation, of course, that seems really utterly inaccessible to us, because our experience is, I have to do this, I have to see, I have to think, I have to cook, I have to eat. The three malas are, in tantric Shaivism, they're not seen as real obscurations, and there are many traditions in which they are. For instance, in Sufism, or even in Buddhism, in many of the sects of Buddhism, the idea is that we are constantly engaged in this process of purifying the obscurations. And in Buddhism, there's a meditation that some of you have probably done where you imagine the Buddha Vajrasattva on top of your head in union with his consort, and the bliss of their union flows down through the crown of the head as a mist. And as you repeat the 100-syllable mantra that goes with this visualization, you imagine this pure stream of light and nectar literally driving the gray clouds of impurities out of your body. The understanding of the tantras is that these three impurities are not real things. They are concepts, they're assumptions that consciousness takes on that filter reality. And the important thing about us is about this is that because they're ideas, even though they're obviously very powerful and sticky ideas, they will eventually fall away, like cataracts, which can be removed from the eyes. But while they're there, of course, they completely filter our experience. And those of you who are interested in neurobiology and quantum physics, you know that there's a lot of cutting-edge work these days, and it's been there for a while, more than 50 years, which shows that we actually have no concrete proof that the world exists outside our experience of it. Cognitive science maintains that the brain, or these branches of cognitive science, maintain that the brain and nervous system create pictures of reality that turn the energy soup, as Deepak Chopra calls it, into very specific forms and gives us the experience that the qualities or qualia of reality, which are things like softness and hardness and sharpness and fluidity and stickiness and coolness and heat, you know, we experience reality really through sensation and perception filtered through the brain and nervous system. But what the tantras say is that prior to the brain and nervous system, there is this this filtration system that consciousness imposes on itself, on herself, which allow us to see a reality outside ourselves that actually is not outside ourselves, that is actually part of one vast whole. And the three mullas are contractions of the three great powers of Shiva Shakti, which are, as we've said earlier, the power of supremely free will, called Ichha Shakti, the power of knowing and apprehending anything and everything, which is called Jnana Shakti, and the power of unobstructed action, which is called Kriya Shakti. So these three powers, when they contract, the power of will contracts into Anavamala, the power of knowing contracts into Mayamala, which is experienced through the mind, and the third contracts into Karmamala. So I want to describe them piece by piece. We'll do some practices with them. And then in the week to come, I'm going to ask you to start to look into the voices of the malas in your own mind, because it's enormously helpful when we're coming to understand why it is that we're not always in the best state we could be in or the state we'd like to be in. It's very helpful to understand what those meta voices sound like in us personally. As we said, the Ichha Shakti, God's power of will, Chitti's power to will, is utterly unrestricted, unlimited. Chitti can will anything. She's utterly spontaneous. But in order to create a sense of self as a limited consciousness, she actually creates a sense of separation within herself at the very moment when she is deciding to manifest as a world. And in that moment, the sense of unlimited freedom is, it's not really restricted, obviously, but it gives the experience of being restricted, of being disempowered, and literally shrinks the vastness into an atomic individual, which is essentially what we were discussing in the tattvas, in the tattva chart. It's that level of purusha, the level of pure consciousness, but it's a pure consciousness that experiences itself as tiny, as an individual. And here, you know, in the West, of course, being an individual is considered one of our strengths, one of the best things in the Tantra. Being an individual means that you're not experiencing yourself as God, so it's not a good thing. And the feeling, a hallmark of Anavamala, is the sense of being incomplete, imperfect, lacking something, being apurna. Purna means complete, means not. So it's this pre-conscious feeling of not being okay, not being good. It is, I believe, the source of what the Book of Genesis describes as the original sin. But in, again, in in a non-dual system, there is no such thing as original sin. There's only Chitti Shakti's decision to become an individual, and the consequences of that decision for most of us are a fundamental feeling of lacking true self-esteem, of lacking true self-love. And this is true for everybody, including people who, you know, who seem to have a lot of confidence, who are very healthy. Down at the core, we're always looking for love elsewhere because we are not experiencing the love that is innate in us. And therefore, everything that follows, you know, you look for someone to love you, and much of your personality and your ways of dealing with life are strategies to fill the hole in your self-love, which also, and this is really important, it also causes you to distrust reality. There's, you know, a kind of core distrust of reality's capacity to hold us that is the result of anavamala. Again, if we have had healthy upbringings and, you know, good caregivers in early childhood, it's this sense of not trusting may be much less intense than it is for people who haven't had, you know, such good early childhood conditioning, but it's there because it's the result of anavamala. And that feeling of lack is what causes us to crave things from outside us. It's the cause of the force of desire that that most of the spiritual traditions regard as problematic, because it's a desire that comes out of lack. You know, Shakti's desire is really the expression of her own overflowing fullness. It's just the flowing forth of utterly free will, an expression of her bliss. Contracted will is almost always accompanied by a sense that you don't have something and that you need to get it from elsewhere. So, as we know, there are all sorts of objects of desire, from the mother's breast to the toy, to the lover, to the prize, to the TV show that you watch in order to relax, to the food that you fill yourself with in order to fill your emptiness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, that said, desire, and this is a whole conversation that we're not going to have tonight, but according to the tantrikas, because remember, desire is always divine, no matter what stage of contraction it's in. And desire is the source of creativity in this life. It's through our desires that we expand and grow and achieve and make new things. And as we become more and more full, through our sadhana, essentially, that those desires often arise as an expression of fullness. And the feeling of incompleteness will eventually resolve itself as a feeling of a feeling that's sometimes described, to use the words of an old song by Peggy Lee, this feeling of, is that all there is? Is what I've acquired all there is? Because nothing really makes you totally happy for long except immersion in the truth of yourself. It's a spiritual truism that I think is very true, that when you really understand what desire really desires, your desire becomes longing. And that longing is for deep spiritual connection, a longing for God, or a longing for truth, or a longing for the happiness that remains even when life doesn't feel so good. Another thing that's important about anavamala, about this sense of incompleteness, this sense of smallness, is that it is what's called the primal contraction. And in its, to understand that anavamala, the fundamental lie that you are not God, has been, let's say, created in us by Chitti herself. it's often called the innate impurity because essentially it's part of our wiring. And what the tantric texts tell us is that the only way to remove anavamala is through grace, through the mystical process that Shema Raja calls Shaktipat, which literally means descent of Shakti, even though it's usually not experienced as a descent, but often as a kind of an uprising. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So once anavamala has arisen and contracted us at this primal level so that the endless vastness of Chitti is now experiencing herself as a tiny atomized particle of consciousness squeezed down to a raisin, it begins to throw up a lot of primal feelings that you might recognize, like I'm insignificant, I don't matter, I'm powerless, I'm a mistake. You know, these feelings that feel so personal are actually not personal. They are the universal feelings or voices of anavamala. And that includes feelings of sadness, loneliness, grief, that for many of us are there even before we have something to be sad about. And of course, when something does happen in our lives that triggers sadness in a particular specific way, it meets that deep feeling of anavamala, of being cut off from God, and then it just really feels bad. So it's always very important to remember the upside of anavamala, which is the fact that it is in the very fact that it limits us and causes suffering, it is also the aspect of ourselves that eventually begins to show us that there has to be something else that becomes that longing. And let us just take a moment. We're going to come back to this a few times, but what you can start to realize with this is that there are certain thoughts and feelings that are markers of the anavamala contraction. And I'm going to just say a couple of them, and I'd like you to listen to these words and see where you feel them, where you experience their effects in your body. I'm small. I'm lacking. I'm unconnected. I'm imperfect. I'm incomplete. I'm alone. I'm a tiny creature on an insignificant planet, moving through space. My lifespan is finite. I don't know who I really am. Just notice the feeling that comes with having those thoughts and recognize that in the normal course of things, those thoughts are being played back to you, not only from inside yourself, but from the entire from the messages that we receive from the culture, especially contemporary secular culture, which with all its wonderful dignities, and I deeply admire contemporary secular culture, tends to invite us to magnify that feeling of being small and alone and cut off from the universe. And we'll be talking about antidotes in just a moment. Because the great thing about the tantras is that wherever there is poison, there's an antidote. In other words, every aspect of contraction contains within it the opportunity to follow the thread of contraction back to the truth, which is that every path that takes us down takes us back up. The poison is the nectar, is a mysterious and important tantric saying. And that by which we fall, meaning the contracting power of Chitti, is that by which we rise, meaning her power to uplift us through grace. So once the malas, once anavamala is in place, the contracting process of Chitti Shakti then starts to give us the experience of the psychic instruments which are able to meet experience and differentiate it. So Anavamala makes us feel small, then Mayamala makes us feel like a particular individual, different from other individuals, having specific characteristics, inhabiting a world in which everything we meet seems different than us. And not only that, seems to have its own particular characteristics. The Mayamala is a contraction of Chitti's power to know, her jnana shakti. And this limits our capacity to see and recognize, to grok the wholeness. So instead of, for example, in daily life, instead of feeling the kind of primal confidence that everything we need to know will be revealed, that we are being guided because, you know, knowledge is really also a guidance system. We get cut off from the natural guidance of Shakti, which is our birthright, and then we start having to figure out strategies for getting through life. And, you know, needing to get information, needing to study, needing to understand reality in particular ways. And again, human inventiveness and the human mind, the human psychic instruments have created extraordinary fields of knowledge and action through our mind and senses. But they are always experienced as particular. And that experience of them as particular is actually the precursor to many of the things that cause life to be difficult, such as private property, ownership, debt, you know, the stuff that comes out of this feeling of me being me and you being you and everything being different and separate and categorizable. So, as I said, Mayamala operates in the tattvas of mental operation, in the space where Chetana, the pure individualized consciousness, becomes Chitta, and begins to function as the intellect, as the sense mind, and as the famous Ahamkara, the ego. Again, as we've said, these abilities are carried in the physical body by the brain and nervous system, but they are also present, as many of you have experienced, I know, in states where the brain and nervous system are not really operating. So Mayamala is a kind of primal measurement filter, and it's the source of, you know, what we said earlier about the differentiating qualities in our nervous system and brain. Are Mayamala is the precursor of those, and its message is always, I'm like this and you're like that. I'm me and you're you. I am somewhat like you, but I'm not totally like you. And sometimes, you know, Mayamala and Karma Mala are both veils that we can remove through our practice and through our commitment to seeing through them. They are, in a certain sense, under our control. And much of the practice that we do is for attenuating Mayamala and Karma Mala. So you may have had the experience of actually seeing through the veil of Mayamala very often in meditation or just after meditation, when you come out and open your eyes and you can see the world as part of a whole. You can even experience objects outside you as rising and falling in your awareness, somehow part of the underlying field. So Mayamala can be seen through, and sometimes we see through it quite soon in our process, sometimes it takes a while. That voice that compares and categorizes and sorts and names does also come up in meditation. And I just want to say, some of the voices, some of the ways in which we may hear the voices of my Yamala. You know, everyone has their own version of it, but it might sound like, I don't understand, I need more information, that's right and that's wrong, I don't agree with that. Then all of our beliefs about reality come in. I'm a non-dualist, so I don't believe in goddesses. I'm a liberal Democrat, and I don't like the right-wing legislature. I like border collies and not terriers. She's beautiful. I think she's unattractive. I'm American, and you're Israeli. So let's see if we can find the Maya Yamala experience. Let's start by seeding an enlightened thought and notice what happens as the, let's call it the ordinary mental consciousness reacts to it. So look around with the thought, all this is part of my own awareness. Now for some of you at this moment, perhaps for many of you, this thought, all this is part of my own awareness, might open you to a sense of connection with the objects that are appearing in front of you. But even if you're experiencing a connection, see if you could notice how there's a part of your mind that is arguing, that is saying, what? You know, what? Is this really, is all of this part of my awareness? Or if you're, you know, well-educated, a student of non-duality, who are predisposed to believe what the tantric sages say about it, you might notice, this is very subtle, but you might notice yourself trying to reframe your immediate sensual sensory experience to accommodate this non-dual idea. So your senses and mind are telling you that I am inside this skin suit and everything else is outside it. But your higher understanding is actually in this moment perhaps in competition with what your senses and ordinary mind are telling you, because that story of difference and separation has so much traction in your consciousness. So just notice both the way in which the mind can actually expand itself with a thought like, all this is part of my awareness, which is, of course, what we're all about here, but simultaneously can contract itself with, I'm not sure I believe that, or I'm not having that experience, or I had this experience day before yesterday, but I'm not having it now. All that is my Yamala. In our developmental life, you know, it's often said that a small baby, a newborn baby, experiences no separation from the mother. The mother feels like a part of herself, of himself. And then gradually we learn to separate from the mother so that, you know, at some point, I think in the first 6 months of life or maybe even before that, the child starts to experience herself as a separate body than the mother's body. The truth is, this is what makes it possible for us to function in the world. But even from the beginning, Maya Yamala is telling us stories about reality. And most of the stories that it tells us about reality are not true. And many of them are not true in a way that actually creates a lot of difficulty in the world, as well as a lot of sweetness. I've just been listening to a podcast called Seeing White about how the idea of race as the way it's held in America today got started. And it's very interesting because apparently race is not in our genome. That is, the DNA of people who are called Negroid and the DNA of people who are called Caucasian or you know, who are called Oriental or Mongoloid, is not, it has like, there's like a 1% difference, and most people who are called white share the full DNA with people who are called Negro, race is not a real biological thing, and you know, in the deepest sense, it's actually a construction that's come about in more or less intense ways over the course of 400 or 500 years. This is an extreme form of Mayamala, which starts with this idea: how can this sofa be part of my consciousness? How can this other person be part of my consciousness? They seem so different from me, and then we create more and more differentiations. And it also operates at subtler and subtler levels. A few months ago, I went on a meditation retreat as a participant rather than as the teacher. And the teacher was a Ramana Maharshi-style direct path teacher who basically taught it's all consciousness and nothing that you see or think is real. I'm a little bit not doing justice to his teaching, but never mind. But as I listened to his lectures, I would notice my mind would keep translating his language into tantric language and evaluating how what he was saying compared with what I believe about reality. And I also noted, I wasn't really being judgmental, but I was comparing because the Mayamala in the mind understands things by comparing. And this happens, of course, even in meditation. Oh, I'm feeling something in my chest. This must be the heart center opening. Or, is this the experience of Chaitanya, pure inner witness, or am I just experiencing momentary blankness of mind? There are many ways to work with Mayamala, and most of our spiritual practice, especially in contemporary world, is essentially about defanging Mayamala. Meditation is the great classic way of helping us see past the differentiating conceptual understanding of Mayamala. And these practices that we were doing last week of looking through the content of thoughts to the energy at their core and looking at how we can work creatively with thoughts and even dissolve them is one of the ways in which we work directly with Mayamala. By we learn how to defang or dissolve thoughts by seeing them as energy and ultimately as chitti. Another kind of Mayamala practice, which I like a lot, and I know that many of you do, is Byron Katie's work, where she uses inquiry to break down your assumptions about what's real. So, again, I know many of you know this work, but just to give an example, someone will say, my husband should treat me with more respect or should be more loving, or, I'm a victim of violence, and it's hard for me to recover my equilibrium. And she will say, sometimes in situations where it's a hard question, is that really true? Should your husband treat you more respectfully, or are you really a victim? And and then what would happen if you let that thought go? And just who would you be without that thought? Can you reframe the experience you're having? Can you look at the experience you're having without the frame of that story? So I often feel that her approach is very mind-centered, but the truth is that that is how we work with Mayamala. We work with Mayamala by looking at what the mind is telling us. And one of the first steps is to start to deconstruct the story. So, in Jnana Yoga is often said to be the yoga of deconstruction, because we look into thoughts and ideas and we question them. We inquire, is this true? Is this real? Can I take a different perspective? And as we follow that, especially if we're very rigorous about it, eventually we really do start to see through the concepts, and even to see through the root conceptualization process that is Mayamala. So let's just take a moment and turn inside. We're about to look at Karma Mala, which has to do with the body. So as we do that, let's return to our original meditation and start to sense the experience, the embodied experience that you're having in this moment with your eyes closed. It's way easier to do it with your eyes closed. Rather than applying the label body to your experience, see if you can feel into yourself as simply a mass of sensation. See if you can feel the vibratory quality of sensations. See if you can allow the breath to move through this field of sensation as a subtler sensation. Not so much feeling I'm breathing or breath is coming in and out of the body as feeling the subtle tactile interplay of the air meeting the sensations. Vibration that we're not calling body. And the categorizing tendency will come up. The questioning will come up. Just keep falling back into the sense of yourself as a mass of sensations that doesn't have to be defined in language, which is being empowered and enlivened by this flowing energy that we don't call breath, because we're just opening ourselves to experience it without defining or differentiating. Karma Mala, according to the tradition, comes in at the point where consciousness is growing organs of action and ultimately a physical body with which it can interact with the apparent physical universe. And Karma Mala is basically boils down to the belief, I am the body and I am doing stuff. I'm giving this class. I'm taking this class. Karma Mala is very, very nailed to this feeling of being the doer. Last year we studied the Bhagavad Gita, much of which is about working with Karma Mala and how we do it. And of course, Karma Mala, which means the impurity of action, the impurity of being the actor, being the one who acts. You know, the Maya Mala tells you, I'm Jenny, I'm an accountant, I'm divorced, I'm happy right now. I'm agitated. And then believing that you're Jenny, you identify with your actions. And what is really happening is that actions are being performed through the, let's call it the puppet or the cutout that Shakti has created that, you know, your mother calls Jenny. So, and when you identify yourself as the body and as a doer of your actions, what is it that, what are the words that come up? I mean, just think about it. One of them, of course, is I'm fat or I'm skinny or I'm strong or I'm sick. But more what this text is saying is that the primal contraction of karma mala is I am responsible for, I am doing this and I'm responsible for the consequences. And that this is, of course, the source of the infamous experience of karma. The feelings that go along with karma mala, and again, you can look at yourself and notice how this works for you, is they often relate to the success or failure of your actions. So, and, you know, most of us feel competent in some ways, competence and power. And the frustration of not being competent enough or not being powerful enough to impact the world in the way we would like. All of this is the expression of karma mala. And in fact, you know, much of the way we run the world, creating ethical and moral guidelines and laws and customs that allow, at, you know, in best case scenario, a kind of free flow of happiness-inducing actions on the part of the individuals. But the whole basis of a world in which people have roles and you know, in which actions have consequences that we get to experience. All of this is based on karma mala. And karma mala, I would say, is that aspect. It's the one of the malas that is actually easiest to see through, even though it's so concrete. I just listened to an interview with a guy who coaches professional tennis players, and he was describing a technique that he discovered and that he now teaches, which he says is a surefire way to get into the zone, which is, as you know, it's that space, that inner state, which seems to have come up originally in the context of tennis, because Billie Jean King was the first person who ever talked about it. It's this place where your game is happening perfectly and you're just, you know, you're playing, but you don't feel like you're playing it. It's like something is playing through you. So he says that at one point, he was playing tennis, and he started to, he for some reason, he doesn't say why, he imagined himself looking through a picture window that was about as far away from him as his arm with the racket in it could reach. And that when, and that, so that he was playing, but he was behind the glass. And he noticed that when the ball came to the point where the window was, his racket knew exactly how to hit it, and without even focusing on where he wanted the ball to go, which is what you're told to do in conventional tennis, the ball would just go to the right spot in the court. He won game after game. And he said that he, of course, you have to practice this, because staying in the zone is a razor's edge, because what he calls the ego, which I think is a mechanism of karma mala, is going to come in and own the shot, is going to say, oh my God, look at that, I made the shot, or oh my God, can I do it again? And then of course you're out of the zone. So, you know, karma mala can be dissolved in the moments when you are one with your actions. And most people who practice a performing art or, you know, serious sports or even unserious sports, we'll have this experience. That said, though, when we're not actually working on dissolving our identification with the body, our actions and the effects of their actions leave traces, which create behavior patterns and give rise to tensions and contractions in the body, which then constrict the experience of consciousness leaving through a body, moving through a body. And the only way through this is through the advice that Krishna famously tells his Padawan, Arjuna, in the Bhagavad Gita. For those of you who haven't seen Star Wars movies, Padawan is essentially the Star Wars name for disciples. Krishna says, you believe that you're the one who acts. You're the fighter, you're the killer. You believe it's your own choice as to whether you fight or not. I'm paraphrasing. But the truth is, he says, you're not in control of your own actions. He says this again and again. It's Prakriti. It's Shakti herself who acts. It's she who causes your limbs to move, and she's going to do it whether you want to or not. Which is a really radical idea for Arjuna, and it's a really radical idea for us when we start to see that. I have a friend who 2 years ago drove in one night from Los Angeles to Santa Fe, New Mexico, in a state of meditation without having the slightest idea what road he was on. I mean, that is fairly extreme. But his experience was that something was driving, and maybe that's what happens when, you know, people take an Ambien and drive the car or eat everything in the refrigerator. It can be looked on as an experience of how action takes place without necessarily any owning of the action. Our experience as individuals, our belief and conviction in our separate experience is colored by these malas. And I think most of you have kind of figured out the fact that pretty much every spiritual practice that we do and pretty much everything that every tradition offers us in terms of self-transformative practices, one way or another works with the malas. In other words, spiritual practice is essentially an antidote to contraction. And in the tantras, there's an entire sort of spiritual science of fitting the type of meditation or the type of ritual or the type of mantra to the mala that it works with. So, for example, we might work with karma mala through asana or tai chi, where we learn to feel into the flow of energy through the body and realize what actually powers our physical being. And we might practice with the knots or tensions in the body, moving into the tension, breathing into the tension, because, of course, breath practice almost automatically puts us in touch with the prana, which is a subtler level of ourselves. And in finding out how to allow ourselves to be moved by prana, we begin to loosen our identification with the physical body. Krishna's great teaching about offering your actions to God, or the Buddhist practice of dedicating your actions for the benefit of all beings, are the two great methods of detaching yourself from karma mala. And I do think that Buddhist practice, Buddhist bodhicitta practice, Tonglen practice, the very skillful practices that the Buddhists have come up with to get us to identify not so much with our separate self, but with our connection, our connectedness, they're very, very effective for loosening the karma mala contraction and also for loosening the maya mala contraction. And then there are all these modern methods like Feldenkrais and somatic therapy and re-education of habitual physical patterns, which actually go directly into our embodiment, into our physical self, and start to give us the experience that even though the physical body feels very dense, that actually it isn't, and that the subtle mental and pranic interventions that we do in the body help us reimagine ourselves or re-understand ourselves as non-physical. So karma mala practices to dissolve karma mala might include most rituals, especially that involve making physical offerings or bowing or prostrating yourself, mudras or a ritual dance, purify the body so that it loosens karma mala. And the trick with all of them, of course, is to learn how to detach yourself from the egoic identification with your performance and actually let the flow happen so that you are able to, as the Vijnana Bhairava says, to recognize that the real ritual is taking place on a subtle level and that the body is actually the instrument but not the self. And of course these practices also loosen maya mala. So many of the inner body practice that we do here and in the different yoga and meditation communities we work with are aimed at purifying the content and the structure of our thoughts. My guru always used to say that sadhana is about the mind, that essentially what we do when we do sadhana is basically purify the mind. And what, you know, we might start by noticing the mood that is engendered by a negative thought. We start to notice the difference between the feeling state that we get into when we're thinking negative thoughts and the feeling taste of a positive thought. And we might step by step start cultivating pure and positive thoughts. This practice is deeply enshrined in the tantric tradition. I mean, it's, of course, a big part of modern New Age practice as well. But Abhinavagupta used to say, one who wishes to have access to her divine nature should first of all purify her thoughts. And he actually talks about the process, the sort of virtuous cycle that happens as we practice holding good, great thoughts. He says, one pure thought leads to another pure thought, and that leads to a third pure thought. In other words, we create a train of positive, enlightened samskaras. And the text will emphasize this in the last couple of sutras, because the practice of creating impressions that will free us is absolutely crucial to the experience of letting go of maya mala. The practice of pratipaksha bhavana, which I know all of us do, substituting positive thoughts for negative ones. Mantra repetition is a huge practice for working with maya mala. Contemplating these teachings is little by little removing the tendency to seeing through the veil of maya. These teachings in and of themselves are dismantling the mayic qualities of your mind. Another practice that I find very effective is to focus on the energetic experience of a thought or of an emotion, and then tuning into the felt sense of the energy and letting it dissolve or resolve into consciousness, into its basis, instead of dwelling on the story. Somebody wrote into the listserv I read today about reading the first sutra and, you know, feeling the vibration of the Sanskrit and then just not grokking what the English was saying. And that as she said it again and again to herself, and I assume thinking about it, contemplating it, a natural understanding of what the sutra was saying, which in my experience of this work doesn't happen because you've intellectually figured it out, although you can, of course, figure it out. But it happens by introducing these very, very pure and true ideas into your psyche and letting them transform, alchemize your psyche. This is how, it's one of the main ways we dissolve maya mala. So the Pratyabhijna Hridayam itself is a maya mala intervention. So as it gives you practice in identifying yourself at subtler and subtler levels and subtleizing your mind through the teachings. As I said, the two, so to speak, subsidiary malas, karma and maya, can be worked with through practice. Anava mala, the primary contraction, which makes Shiva and Shakti feel cut off from each other and from their vastness, their oneness, is the wiring that Chitti has put in place at the beginning of the process. And what we call awakening in modern life and is called in is what Kshema Raja refers to as the effect of Shaktipat, which Shaktipat literally means descent of Shakti, but what it actually is the decision by Chitti Shakti to reveal herself inside you. And for some people, this revelation is a sudden recognition of the fact that you are not what you thought you were. It can come about as a sense of, you know, I'm not the body, I am pure consciousness. It can come as a sense of kundalini awakening and rising through your system. And in fact, Shaktipat will eventually awaken your kundalini, because kundalini is the form of the primordial chitti, which lives inside your subtle system for the purpose of purifying the subtle vessel that we call the chakra system and the sushumna nadi and all the other nadis, such that we are able to hold the experience of oneness. And the anavamala, according to Abhinavagupta and many other sages in this tradition, anavamala is actually removed in the moment that we receive Shaktipat, or that kundalini is awakened, or that we have the awakening, that, you know, perhaps the more dramatic awakenings. But usually we don't realize it until more work has been done or more purification has been done, resolve maya and karma malas. So many of you can say with confidence that your anavamala has already been removed. It's just that there's some purification that has to be done before you recognize the full effects of it. And the experience of Shaktipat, of being touched by the revelatory grace power of Shakti, is what brought us all together. I mean, I really, in my years of studying these teachings, what I've seen is that you cannot feel an affinity with this tradition without having been touched by the revelation of Shaktipat. It may not have been dramatic in your case. It may have, you know, your experience of Shaktipat may be a very subtle turning towards inwardness. It may, you know, it may have been that impulse that sent you to yoga class or sent you to a teacher or made you start meditating. But that the very subtle first impulse of awakening is really the beginning of the end of your journey as a bound soul and the beginning of your journey into pure presence, pure awareness. And we're going to speak about this in much more detail when we get to the sutras in the later part of the book, which talk about the process of awakening in its most inward and esoteric form. But what I'd like to do now, let's take a few breaths. Just a moment of assimilatory silence. We're going to go into an exercise, and it's a little bit of a thought experiment. One of my old friends, who is the author of the book, Everything is Consciousness, or actually I think the book is called Consciousness is Everything, Swami Shankarananda, describes a meditation that he had in which he recognized that the three malas are actually connected to the three subtle centers, the three centers in the subtle body. That is to say, the navel chakra, the navel center, the heart chakra, the heart center, and the center in the middle of the head, the third eye center. And if you remember your yogic scriptures, which I know many of you do, there's one of the teachings of yoga is that, especially of the the Hatha Yoga tradition and the Kundalini aspect of the Hatha Yoga tradition is that there are three knots that are positioned in these three chakras. That there's a knot at the navel, a knot at the heart, and a knot in the center of the head, which, and each of these knots creates a kind of impenetrable, or to the ordinary mind, barrier to the rising of Kundalini energy, but it also literally contracts our ability to experience the subtlety of these chakras, each of which contains an extraordinarily beautiful world that as these knots start to loosen, we can start to experience in meditation. And the way he experienced this was that the knot in the navel center is actually related to the contraction of Karma Mala. The knot in the head center is related to Maya Mala, and the primal knot of the heart, which is in the heart center, is related to Anava Mala. And his great insight, which I have found to be really very helpful, was that the tensions that we experience in these centers, in these parts of the body, are indications of the fact that we're being contracted by the malas here in these parts of the body. So I want to do a brief process for tuning into the malas on a somatic level, on a feeling level. And the levels, let's say, of sensation, somatic sensation, but also of the emotions that arise that we can start to identify in by tuning into these places in the body, and the thoughts, of course, that come up, that surround them, and that can often trigger them. Many of us have the experience, and this was a very big deal when I first discovered it, that the tensions, that the actual physical tension, the somatic tension that's run throughout our bodies, and that so much of our work is about dissolving and resolving. The physical tensions in the body are the residue of the malas. And that said, of course, everybody has their own traumas that are personal to us, and that coagulate around the centers and the tension, the original tensions from the malas, and make them much more intense. But at the heart of them, the heart of our tension is these fundamental contractions. If you look into these experiences, into the tensions in the different centers, what you often discover is that there's a very coherent expression of this particular mala in this particular place. So I'm just going to tell you my experience, and then we're going to practice it. And actually, you can follow me as I speak. I'm going to give you some instructions that you can follow as I speak, and then I'm going to give you some suggestions that you might work with. So just begin. We'll begin with this inquiry. Focus on the navel, on the region of the navel, and a great way to do that is to put your hand just with, I'm using the right hand, you can do the same thing with the left actually. Place your hand so that your thumb, your hand is flat against your solar plexus, and your thumb is just underneath the rib cage, or not just, like just touching the bottom of the rib cage. The lower part of your hand is touching the belly button, the navel, and bring your attention in the inner body behind that, your hand, into the center of your body. And breathe with the sense that the diaphragm domes down with the inhalation and up with the exhalation, not too hard. And see if you can notice the tightness or the contraction there, if there is any. Ask into the feeling, is there anything that you have to say to me or show me? Is
there an image or a thought that arises not spontaneously? When you focus in this center, now, introduce a couple of thoughts here. I'm going to give you some thoughts that tend to contract me. You can work with them, or if another comes up, you can work with that thought. Have the thought, I'm weak. I have a lot to do. I'm really busy. Just notice what happens to the energetics in your navel chakra, in that region of your body with those thoughts. I find that they tighten. I tighten. Now try it with the thought, I am strong and capable. I can do whatever I need to do. Just breathe into the navel center with that thought. And notice the feeling that arises there. And now let's breathe in an enlightened thought. Shakti, the power of the universe, is acting through this body. Whatever has to be accomplished, she is accomplishing. And notice the feeling in the navel center when you have that thought. Everything is being done by the primordial Shakti. And bring your attention to the center of the head. The Ajna chakra, the sixth chakra, is in the very center of the head. It's behind the forehead, behind the brow. But I find it's easiest to find it if I put the tip of my tongue up against the hard palate, the top of the mouth, and then just bring my attention above it. So see if you can focus there at the sixth chakra in the center of the head. And breathe. Do you feel some tension there, some tightness, a kind of energetic hardness perhaps? The contraction in the third eye. Now, inhaling, have the thought, I'm confused. I have to understand this better. I'm not sure I believe it, but I'm trying to figure it out. Thoughts like that. Notice the feeling in the head center when you have those thoughts. Notice how the energy feels. And now change the thought, I am smart. I understand this. In fact, I understand it better than she does. Just feel the energy there. And now have the thought, my mind is an expression of the great mind. My mind is filled with the infinite wisdom of the absolute consciousness. I can know whatever is needed. I am wisdom itself. How does the energy feel in the center of the head with that thought, I am wisdom itself? Is there a release, a relaxation? A feeling of settling? Now with your next inhalation, bring your awareness behind the breastbone into the heart center, just a little bit to the right of the physical heart, in the center of the body. You can put your hand there if it helps you connect. And let the breath come into the heart with the thought, I am an individual. Unique and separate from the universe. And I need love. I need to feel love. I need to receive love. I am an individual. I'm separate from the universe. I need love. Notice the energy. Notice the way the energy feels when you're having that thought. Notice that for me it shows up as a kind of desiring or craving or almost a nervousness. And there's very definitely a feeling of neediness, lack, wanting to be filled up. Now change the thought again. Still keep breathing into the heart. Change the thought to, I get a lot of love from others. I get a lot of love from others. I'm a good person. I'm loving. And notice the energy of that. Notice that there's probably some relaxation, some decontraction. Now introduce this thought. I am love itself. I am love itself. Love flows through this body from every corner of the universe. I am love. Even in contraction, Chitti reveals to us the antidotes. And even in contraction, as we'll discuss next week. Chitti manifests her great powers and continues to perform the fundamental actions that are her nature and her birthright, and to reveal to us ways of recognizing who we really are, even when we're thinking and acting as limited individuals. So let's sit for a moment, just letting the breath flow through the heart. Flow into the heart, flow through the heart, very softly. With the mantra, I am love. I am love. I am love, flowing in with the inhalation, touching the heart. And then with the exhalation, just allow yourself to feel the energetic radiance that this great thought, this Mahavakya, arouses in you. And as we bring our contemplations and our investigations to a close, let's put our hands over the heart, the right hand over the chest and the left hand on top of it. Take a deep breath in and allow the breath to sigh out with Om. Oh, oh, oh. Have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. The audio will be available tomorrow, and your meditation homework will come tomorrow, and the partner and contemplation work the next day. Our homework for this week is not as elaborate as it has been for the last couple of weeks, just to give you guys a chance to catch up on what you've missed, what you haven't had time for. And next week we'll begin with Sutras 10 and 11. So much love. Namaste.